Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Just a quick programming note, if you're tuning in looking for our interview with Dr. Ngozi Ezike that we've been promoting, that had to be postponed. We hope to bring that to you later this week. As I said at the top of the show, cases of COVID-19 are moving up across the country pretty severely in some states, not as severely, but still up in Illinois. There were 954 newly confirmed cases on Sunday, and the seven-day average is up 21% over a week earlier, almost 40% over late June when the state moved into phase four of easing restrictions and allowing more and more businesses to reopen more broadly. So I want to welcome back David Shaper, a national reporter from NPR, focusing on transportation. And we're also joined now by Stephanie Zimmerman, a consumer affairs reporter at the Chicago Sun-Times, Neil Early, also with the Chicago Sun-Times, based in Springfield, and Morley Music, who is a freelance reporter in Chicago, whose most recent story that we're going to be talking about has been for Southside Weekly, also written for The Nation and other publications. Welcome to all of you. And Stephanie, I want to start with you and turn to another coronavirus economic story on which you've been reporting. Illinois and Chicago have prohibited evictions during the pandemic. I believe the state order extends through the end of July, but you found that that isn't always keeping people in their homes, right?
Yeah, that's right. There's supposed to be a ban on evictions for non-payment of rent that goes through the end of this month. That was an extension by the governor. But some landlords that have gotten frustrated with not getting any money are doing illegal evictions, essentially getting rid of tenants outside the normal court process, doing things like changing the locks, turning off electricity. In some cases, they've come in to say they need access to do a repair, and then they mess around with a major appliance so that it's unusable. Taking out toilets was another one we heard about.
Oh,
just kind of making life miserable so that people will get out and they can try to get a paying tenant in.
And this is technically legal, I guess? Taking out
No, that's
toilet?
Completely illegal.
It's illegal. Oh, okay. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, all of that is illegal. All of that is illegal. You're not supposed to be able to do that. And especially now because of this this ban on evictions. And some of the housing advocates, people that advocate for tenants are very concerned because even after July 31st, they're worried about the legal evictions that are going to start. That's when the floodgates are going to open and landlords are going to be able to file actual eviction cases in court against people for non-payment of rent.
And is there any recourse that people have, or is the city doing anything to try and address this? Or
yeah, I mean, in some cases, I've heard of tenants that have called 311 in Chicago. Sometimes the police will be helpful. It just kind of depends who responds, because I've heard other stories about police just kind of saying this is a private matter that I don't really want to get involved in. Hmm. But the Metropolitan Tenants Organization has tried to help people. I talked to them about kind of how much this is happening, and they said in the first 3 months of the crisis, so like from mid-March to mid-June, they got about double the number of calls each month. So about 41 calls per month for these illegal lockouts. But they said that that's really just a small fraction of the amount of times that it happens, because most people don't know to report it. And a lot of people, if they have maybe a shaky immigration status, they will not report this. They'll just quietly pack up their things and leave because they don't want the trouble. So it's probably very much underreported.
Hmm. Interesting. All right, Morley Music, I want to bring you into the conversation. Your most recent article in Southside Weekly, it kind of dovetails with this. You investigated the Chicago Housing Authority's program to place people who are homeless in a network of shelters, isolation centers, and hotels. But in your reporting, you found the program is failing in some ways. How so?
Well, I should clarify that I don't think the Chicago Housing Authority is the entity that is housing.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Yes.
In hotels. But Yeah, basically, the primary failure, so far as I can tell, is that they may have potentially hundreds of vacant units that they are not immediately leasing up, that their occupancy level is considerably lower than other housing agencies. And then just that their sort of accounting on vacancies is extremely unclear, that they conducted meetings with housing advocates from the Chicago Housing Initiative and Chicago Coalition for the Homeless for several months before coming out with the position that actually they don't have any vacancies. So that claim, in addition to inconsistencies in their reporting to me and with the Sun-Times, you know, should give rise to some skepticism that they don't have vacancies. But beyond that, they just need to, they need to be able to tell people whether they have them or not and give a precise figure.
So. Yeah, I was intrigued by this aspect of your story, which is that, I mean, it sort of reminded me of, like, I don't know, Nicolas Cage and National Treasure, right? Somebody had to FOIA the department for an April report and kind of interpret it to figure out how many vacant units. Can you talk about, you know, how people come to understand how many vacancies there are and why this isn't, you know, just sort of like a more straightforward thing?
Sure. I wish I had a better understanding of why it's not a more straightforward thing, but the April FOIA I got from the Chicago Housing Initiative, which FOIAs the agency routinely because their own manner of reporting vacancies hasn't been, I don't think that they've released a quarterly report since 2019. So they're behind. So I think FOIAs are the way that you can get the most up-to-date thing. But then what housing advocates told me is that the way the FOIA basically reports their vacancy figures as they report it to HUD, but that their HUD figures don't necessarily reflect what's on the ground. So my sense is it's just a kind of like morass, and some of the most basic information that you would need to keep the agency accountable, namely the number of vacancies, and then a lot of issues about their budget, how much they actually have to spend on housing, how much they intend to spend per year, how much they actually build, is just incredibly difficult to figure out. In my own sense is that, you know, you could spend a little while, maybe a few weeks, organizing this information, and it could be, you know, fit on a single sheet of paper and you know, post online and housing agencies, and it would really make a big difference in terms of holding the agency accountable.
Yeah, so having to file these Freedom of Information Act requests to get this information. I mean, ultimately, what does the CHA have to say for itself here?
I really don't know. They just said that they don't have they don't have any habitable vacancies. They'll talk about that they have lots of uninhabitable vacancies at Lathrop Homes, you know, which have been recently renovated, and I'm sure that's true. In other stories, that they'll cite, you know, lack of administrative capacity. But the bottom line is that there are other housing agencies that maintain much, much higher occupancy rates and much better utilization rates of housing vouchers. And that translates into literally thousands of people having homes. You know, it's a resource, especially when you compare it to the years and years that politicians have to do at the neighborhood level to just get 100 units of affordable housing, like in Logan Square, for instance. And then you just have thousands of subsidized rents or vacant units that could potentially be filled up if the agency was more efficient at it. It's something.
Yeah. All right. So that's in Chicago, which has obviously been the epicenter of the COVID-19 outbreak in Illinois, at least when it peaked earlier this year. Neil Early, for the Chicago Sun-Times, you have been looking at sort of the polar opposite location in Illinois, you know, back when I remember a couple of months ago when I would open every show with the latest COVID-19 stats, I would often say the disease has been found in all but two of Illinois' 102 counties. And then it became all but one of Illinois' 102 counties. Neil, what was the last county in Illinois to be free of known cases of COVID-19?
Yeah, that would be Scott County, Illinois. It's a county about an hour west of Springfield. It's pretty sparsely populated, about 5,000 people, pretty rural, and pretty distant from any sort of major city in central Illinois, over an hour away.
And I gather it recently lost that designation of being the only county in Illinois to, at least, as I said, not have a known case of COVID-19, right?
Yeah, so on July 2nd, it became finally all of Illinois, all the counties in Illinois had a reported case of COVID-19. It held the distinction for about a month when Edgar County had a reported case, and Scott County was the last county in Illinois to have a case.
And what are people there telling you about, you know, their reaction to this? I mean, has it changed the way they're viewing the disease at all?
No, it hasn't changed since they got a case much, given that it's just one reported case. The feeling there is kind of the feeling like the rest of the state. There are some people who are very concerned about the virus, tended to be older people. The county has an older population. Younger people in Scott County are not as worried about coronavirus. They feel a little bit more comfortable, not socially distancing. So it's kind of mixed. Some people are following some of the social distancing guidelines very strictly. Some people are not at all. Some people are very skeptical that coronavirus is a major public health problem. Some people are very concerned about it. But there's been an impact on the community there. Like the rest of the state, Scott County is in phase four and businesses are open. Restaurants and bars are open, but there still are not a lot of people who are frequenting bars and restaurants. In Scott County, there are some people who are going in for a drink, but talking to business owners there, there's not a lot of business going on. Most people are still doing takeout, even though there are some people who are not that worried about coronavirus. And obviously, Scott County is not like Chicago, where there isn't the density. There aren't the cases. There's just one reported case. But some people there are still taking it very seriously.
Okay. If you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We've been speaking with Neil Early and Stephanie Zimmerman of the Chicago Sun-Times, Morley Music, who's a freelance writer in Chicago, written for Southside Weekly and other publications, and David Shaper, national reporter focusing on transportation for NPR. David, last time I talked to you on this show was last year when we were talking about the Boeing 737 MAX, and you've recently sort of followed up on this story. What is the latest happening there? Of course, Boeing, another Illinois-based company.
Yeah, the latest on the plane itself is that Boeing has, with the FAA, been conducting some test flights of their updated, modified flight control software. These are tests of actual certification flights. So the flights are being actually done by FAA pilots. They did this for a couple of days the week before the 4th. There are a couple of follow-up flights, I believe, the following week. They're taking that data, analyzing that data, and the FAA will be soon making a decision about whether or not that plane can return to service. There's still a lot of concern about the safety of the jet. There have been other problems discovered along the line that Boeing has had to go back and fix and address. You know, the whole coronavirus epidemic is kind of, I don't want to say it's worked to Boeing's favor, but relieved the pressure on the company to try to get this plane manufactured again. Airlines don't need a lot of extra planes right now. Mm-hmm. In fact, they're parking, I think the latest figure I saw is about 40% of their fleet, maybe even up to 50%, depending on the airline. So you know, these jets are not as desperately needed as they were just, you know, 6-8 months ago by the airlines. But airlines are still frustrated with Boeing. We saw American Airlines last week threaten to cancel an order for several 737 MAX jets partly because they don't need them as badly as they did before, but also Boeing's on the hook for some of the costs that they've had to incur related to the grounding of the jet, and there are continuing investigations into what went wrong. How is it that Boeing developed a plane with a flawed flight control system that led two planes to repeatedly go into nosedives that the pilots could not recover from? And why is it that the FAA approved that scheme on the plane, those flight control systems? The latest being that there may be a criminal investigation into the possibility that Boeing employees may have lied or deliberately misled the FAA regulators who were overseeing that certification work. So it's an ongoing story. It's a continuing saga, and there are still answers to be had. But Boeing is closer to getting that plane back into service.
Well, we will continue to follow that story here on the 21st. Mm-hmm. Stephanie, I think probably the last question to you, and just in about a minute now, another story you've worked on recently on the Consumer Affairs beat had to do with car insurance. I think some of us might have gotten a refund check for a portion of our insurance premiums, but what did you find was happening at Progressive Insurance?
Yeah, you guys, everybody probably got about as much money, to buy yourself a nice McDonald's lunch or something. The car insurance companies under pressure gave back some of the premium money that they had already collected before the pandemic. Of course, they had no idea that the pandemic would happen. But once it happened and things were shut down, people were not driving. And so accidents were way down and the insurance companies were saving a lot of money beginning in mid-March. In the insurance companies gave some discounts. They vary, but usually about 15% to 20%, and it was for a couple of months. But three different states, California, New Jersey, and Michigan, required refunds and required the insurance companies to give them some data. And I looked at the documents that were filed in Michigan, and you could see how the accidents had dropped precipitously over the spring. And Progressive, their claims were down almost 32%, and that was only in March.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Stephanie Zimmerman is a consumer affairs reporter at the Chicago Sun-Times. Thanks also to the Sun-Times is Neil Early, Morley Music freelance reporter in Chicago, and David Shaper from NPR will tweet out links to all their stories. Thank you all so much for being with us on the 21st today. More to come after a break.